Okay, so move on to our next mitzvah. This is mitzvah number 509. I'll read to you the quote from the Torah, and then we'll discuss what the mitzvah actually is. I'll read the article in English to make it easy for all of us. The quote is, when the Levite will come from one of your cities, from all of Israel, where he sojourns, and he comes with all the desire of his soul to the place that Hashem will choose, then he shall minister in the name of Hashem, his God, like all of his brethren, the Levites, who stand there before Hashem. Portion for portion shall they eat, except for what was transacted by the forefathers. That's the quote, which is very confusing, what that means. So the quote talks about a Levite. It actually is referring to a Kohen. The Kohen descends from Levi. So it's referring to the Kohen in particular.
And this is
in Shoftim. Still in Shoftim. And the mitzvah that we're discussing here is when a Kohen comes to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, they had to make a rotation as to who shall serve, when they'll serve, and who gets the portions of the sacrifices. That's what we mean over here. So to translate into another easier English, it says, portion for portion shall they eat. I mean, they should make an arrangement of who gets what portion. And it says that they shall come and serve in the name of Hashem, which is referring to the fact they should make rotations in terms of the service. So in simple terms, there is some sort of a mandate that Kohanim make a rotation for service rather than have chaos. If everyone shows up at once to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, it would be quite chaotic. And number two, they should be able to divide up the portions of the sacrifices equally amongst themselves. So that's the basic mitzvah we're going to discuss. There shouldn't be confusion, there should be a schedule, there should be shifts, it should be an orderly way to serve Hashem in the Beis HaMikdash. The amount of shifts is not obligated by the Torah. The Torah says make shifts, make an arrangement, make it orderly. The Torah didn't say how to do it. That was up to the Kohanim to decide, how do we want to divide up the service? It actually transitioned over time. In Moshe's times, there were 8 shifts of Kohanim, so they'd have 8. They would switch weekly, and there'd be a 1 week shift, and there are 8 shifts. David HaMelech, King David, and Shmuel, Samuel the prophet, they together set up 24 shifts, which is how it would remain for the rest of history. Was 24. So that number 24 versus 8 wasn't the Torah obligation, but yet the idea of having shifts was an obligation. Additionally, at the Regalim, when you had one of the 3 big pilgrimage festivals, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, they're all on duty. Every single one of them. So even though the rest of the year they had their rotations, they took turns, when it came to a holiday, every Kohen was on duty, because on those days there was a lot of work to do. You had every single Jew coming to the Beis HaMikdash to bring their sacrifices for the holiday, Aliyah LeRegel. So you had a lot of karbanos to offer. There's many offerings, many sacrifices. Everyone bring, in addition to their typical holiday sacrifices, they also bring all the ones they owed throughout the year. Throughout the year, everybody had obligations towards the Beis HaMikdash, and they would wait. Now I'm going up on Pesach time, so I'll keep all these cows over here and these sheep, and I'll bring them with me on Pesach. So they'd come up to the Beis HaMikdash on Pesach, and there'd be tons and tons of work to do. So on those days, everyone's on duty. The rest of the year, they took turns. If you're on duty, you got the benefits of being on duty, which means you get to have the portions of the sacrifices. We discussed a little bit last time I was here, and in general, there's a rule that every sacrifice offered, Kohanim typically get a portion of it, depending on what kind of sacrifice it is. So which Kohanim get it? So the general rule of thumb is that, you know, if you're on duty, you get to have that portion. If you are not on duty, it's not your portion. So we ended up dividing it into 24 different shifts. They're called mishmaros. The idea of a mishmar literally means like a watch. But there's 24 watches, 24 shifts of Kohanim. And they would take turns week by week. So every single Shabbos, one shift would leave, the other shift would begin. That occurred on Shabbos. So there's always a transition on Shabbos of these shifts of Kohanim. Every mishmar, every group of Kohanim had a head who was in charge of that mishmar. And that head would divide the mishmar into families and sub-rotations. I mean, it was a very, very organized, orderly process. So you would show up as a Kohen, you'd show up to your shift once every 24 weeks, and then you might be told, okay, well, your day is going to be Tuesday. And the rest of the week, you'll be around in case we need you, but really, your family is working this Tuesday. And that's what you would do. But it was everything was arranged in a way which was very orderly. As an aside, if you were a Kohen, even if it's not your shift, you're allowed any time to go and offer your own sacrifice. So if my shift's in 10 weeks from now, but I'm personally a Kohen and I have a personal sacrifice to offer, I could approach the Beis HaMikdash and go in and do what I need to do. I don't have to have any special permission. I need to be on duty for that. As long as I'm a Kohen, I can go in and offer my own sacrifices.
But not a sacrifice for somebody
else. Not for someone else, just for myself, correct. If you want to do someone else's, you have to be on the current Mishmar. Right. So that's the mitzvah in general. Now, what's the reason for this? So it seems somewhat obvious that you want to have an orderly way to arrange what happens in the Beis HaMikdash. But I just wanted to explain from the Sefer HaChinuch that he really is able to describe it in a way which is very, very relevant to us. And the Sefer HaChinuch says that whenever you have a task to complete and the responsibilities are clearly marked, put upon specific people for specific tasks, so the job gets done. If there's a job to be done, and it's just given to the masses, you know, we got to get all the sacrifices finished, and you have, you know, 5,000 Kohanim just there, and no one's given a specific job, so it ends up being chaotic. The job doesn't get done. People rely upon the other. There's fighting. There could be a lot of ways why it would not be done properly. Number one, we know that each person will count on the other. Well, I don't have to do it. You'll do it. You don't have to do it, I'll do it. Because there's nobody given the job. That's number one. Number two, there could be fighting. Either because I wanted to do that, you took it away from me, or why didn't you do that, you were supposed to. And as long as the jobs are not clear, there will be fighting amongst the Kohanim, and we can't have fighting in Hashem's holy temple. And then also, people might get lazy about it. You know, as long as there are other people in charge, what do I have to do? I'll sit back here and I'll relax and I'll watch what's happening, and then nothing gets done. We all know this from experience. You've ever been involved in organizations, in a business, in volunteer jobs. When things are clearly delineated, everyone has their specific job description, and things get done very efficiently and very well. When it's just a group of people sitting around, let's get this done, but nobody is told what to do, and nobody is given any sort of task to get done, to accomplish, so everything just kind of gets, you know, things get fall in between the cracks. Things get forgotten. People get lazy. People rely upon each other. People fight. Because it's not specific as to who's supposed to do what. So the Torah, whether it be in a family, in a business, in an organization, and anything we do, if things are not clearly delineated, then typically they're not going to be efficiently executed. It's the concept that the rabbis describe. They use a quote, "Kedera debe shufi lo chamim lo kariri." If you have a pot of partners, it's never hot nor cold. Because one partner says, "I want it to be hot." He turns up the fire. The other guy says, "No, it should be cold." He turns down the fire. So it's going to be somewhere lukewarm. Nothing's going to actually be accomplished at that point. If one person takes charge, okay, this has to be done. You make sure it gets hot. You put in the, you know, it's also the classic example of the too many chefs spoil the broth, in a little different sense. But when people are involved and no one's given specific jobs what to do, you know, if you're told, okay, you're in charge of the salt, you're in charge of the chicken, you're in charge of the vegetables, so then you can make a pot of soup. But everyone's in charge of everything, so then there's too little chicken and too much salt and no vegetables, because there's nobody who's guiding and organizing it all. So it's all the same lesson. Hashem has the foresight to know that human beings need to have structure in if they're going to run or accomplish any sort of task, and therefore he made this halacha, there must be structure in the Beis HaMikdash duties. Hashem didn't say how to do it, but Hashem said make sure there is structure, make sure jobs are divided up properly, or else the avodah is not going to be accomplished. And from experience, we know how important that is. So that's the major point about this mitzvah. Now, we said that the 24 shifts were instituted. And no numbers are ever random. Now, why 24? It began with 8, and then it was moved to 24, and that remained. For the rest of history, there was 24 shifts of Kohanim. We refer to it as 24 Mishmaros. The number 24 is a number commonly used throughout the Torah, throughout Jewish thought. Just for instance, there's 24 books of Tanakh. So that's one of the most famous 24s. 24 books of Tanakh. There's 24 hours in a day, which we know. That's an obvious one. 24 is significant. What's lesser known is that the Medrash tells us in Eicha Rabbah that the city of Yerushalayim was actually designed on 24s. What do I mean? The Medrash says that Rabbi Shmuel taught there were 24, he calls it palthios, which is kind of like marketplaces in Yerushalayim. Every one of these palthios, these marketplaces, had within it 24 alleyways. Every alleyway had within it 24 smaller markets. in every single smaller market, 24 shikakim, which is some sort of, let's say, you know, storefronts. And anyone in all of these different areas had 24 courtyards. Every courtyard, 24 houses. I mean, the number 24 was the number that they designed Yerushalayim upon, the Medrash says. I guess architecturally, city planning was done by 24s. So it's a very significant number. It makes a lot of sense that the Kohanim who are doing the service in the temple also divided by 24. So that's the number that was used for all these different designs of Yerushalayim. That's 24. The commentaries on this medrash say why they choose 24. Why did they design Yerushalayim on 24s in the city planning aspect of Yerushalayim? And the Eitz Yosef, one of the commentaries on the medrash, he says is all meant to represent the 24 books of Tanakh. A Jew has to know that we live upon the Torah. The Torah is our life force. The 24 books of Tanakh are the core of Torah. And therefore, you're going to design Yerushalayim, which is the city of the Torah, upon the 24 books of the Torah, so that's why the number 24 is so significant. So you can furthermore explain there's 24 shifts of Kohanim, because Kohanim do the service of the temple, which brings life to us as well, brings down God's blessing into this world, very similar to the Torah, which is the life force of the Jewish people. So this number 24 is our days, it's the Tanakh, it's Yerushalayim, it represents our life force. The life force is represented by 24. Mathematically, you can work this out. The name of Hashem is four letters, 26. And that could be rearranged. Well, that's gematria, but the letters could be rearranged in 24 different permutations. So that's a Kabbalistic idea, but that's the four. I guess four factorial. As you would do, right? And that gets you to 24. So the that's another idea of 24.
All the other two ways are different.
Well, it's quoted that Aleph Dal and Nun Yud, the way we pronounce it, is four. You're right, or else you'd only have 12.
Right, correct. Well, combinations are perfect.
Right. Additionally, 24 is interesting because the one of the commentaries, Rokeach, he quotes, I didn't look through them all, but he says that the word kapara, atonement, is used 24 times in the Torah, and the word shalom is used 24 times in the Torah. So, you know, the role of the Kohanim is primarily to bring us atonement through the sacrifices. And also, the sages teach us that the role of a Kohen is to bring peace between us and Hashem. The original Kohen was Aaron, a Kohen who was known for his ability to bring peace to the Jewish people. And essentially, the karbanos that were brought were to cover up, you know, we might have done things which are incorrect and created a rift between us and Hashem. The karbanos bringing atonement close up that rift and create peace. So the word peace is there 24 times. The word atonement, kapara, is there 24 times. So the Kohanim also at 24 shifts, which really represents their job. Their job is to bring shalom and to bring kapara, atonement, to the Jewish people. So that's another 24. And interestingly enough, if you look at the Shemona Esrei, the bracha we say about rebuilding Yerushalayim has 24 words to it. Yerushalayim Ircha, if you count the words, there's 24 words in Yerushalayim Ircha as well. Because again, it all fits. The bracha about Yerushalayim should fit the 24 because the Sardis is about 24 and the Tachas, everything's 24s. So this number is a very significant number in terms of Yerushalayim. One more additional point about 24 is that when we say Shema, we say the first line, Shema Yisrael, and then we insert the line, Baruch Shem Kvod Machusel Lamed. Blessed is the name of Hashem's glorious kingdom forever and ever. And Baruch Shem Kvod Machusel Lamed is 24 letters. That's also 24. Shema is 25 letters, and Baruch Shem is 24 letters. The significance of Baruch Shem, in short, this would be a longer discussion, is that Shema talks about how God is one, and Baruch Shem is our ability in this world to recognize God as one. We recognize God as the king of the whole world. So the number 24 has that implication that things break down into different parts, but yet they all point back to the one God. So that's another idea about 24, which that could deserve a longer discussion, but I'm not going to go into that today. But so we say 24, though, is a number which is very significant in Jewish thought and has a lot of usages relevant to the Beis Hamikdash and Yerushalayim. So that's the idea of the 24 different watches or shifts of the Kohanim. Beyond this, so this is not something relevant to this mitzvah. So we think, okay, I don't know who here is a Kohen, but you're a Kohen or is that a Kohanim? What?
Incon Kohen.
So, no Kohen here. So we say to ourselves, okay, so they do all the work of the Beis HaMikdash, and we'll sit back at home and they'll take care of us. But the truth is that there was an idea which was instituted by the prophets that even regular everyday Jews should also have their shift in terms of being a part of the Beis HaMikdash service. How did that work? That was called Maimados. Maimados. So every, it was only men, Jewish men were put onto shifts, also 24 shifts. They were selected from every single city. It was people who were considered, you know, important people in the community. And they were put onto a maimid, onto their own shift. And the job of a maimid was, if it was your week to be on maimid, if you live near your shalayim, you would go to your shalayim. If not, you'd go to the local shul. And for that week, you would fast. You would say special prayers. You would daven in a special way, including even a special Torah reading, including the Ila, similar to Yom Kippur. And during those weeks, you'd be on call, that you are the Jews representing the entire people, that you'll stand by the offerings being brought in the Beis HaMikdash. So it was done either physically in person if you were in your Shalayim, or at least spiritually if you were outside, you'd be in the local shul. But you dedicate that week that you are the Jews who are standing by for the Karbanos. That was the idea.
What do you mean to fast?
They would fast every day. They would fast. They eat at night.
Some men from the Maamadot used to fast every day.
Yeah, or all the men. Every man in the Maamadot would fast.
How many people have to be in the Maamad?
I don't know. I'm not sure how many were actually selected. Okay. There are 24 Maamados, but I don't know how many were in each group. I'm not sure. But it's quoted to be, it was the people in each city that were deemed fit. So they would choose people who were kasherim, the yirei chet, the people who were considered fit and fearful of sin. They'd be put on the maimid, and their job would be, during that week, they're considered the people amongst the entire Jewish people that would be standing in for all of us, to represent us for the Beis HaMikdash service and for the Karbanos. That was their job. And the explanation was given that being that the sacrifice are brought on all of our behalf, you're supposed to be there for your sacrifice. I mean, technically you could send one in and not show up, but you're supposed to be there engaged and involved in the sacrifice as it's happening. So since there were communal offerings brought daily, if you didn't have the community involved, so then we would be passive bystanders, which is not the way to do it. So this is the way that we would actively have representatives being involved in the Karbanos beyond the Kohanim. So they'd fast, they would daven special tefillos, they would have a special Torah reading. The reading would be about Maisa Bereishis, they'd read about creation. And the explanation given was that since the world stands upon the sacrificial service, so they read about creation to show that what we're doing is actually maintaining the world. It's something that we don't fully understand or grasp nowadays, because we don't actually have offerings these days, and we don't have sacrifices. But the sages teach us that the whole world rests upon these sacrifices. So if you were in a maimid, you would actually read from the Torah about Maisa Bereishis, about creation, every single day. They were meant to begin the week, you know, clean and ready, you know, like as if they're in their Shabbos clothes, clean shaven, ready to go. So that week they would not be able to have any haircuts. They're supposed to have a haircut beforehand, like Chol Moed, do laundry beforehand and show up, you know, clean and ready to have a very special week of spirituality.
When was this done? During what period?
During the Beis HaMikdash times.
During both?
During both, I believe, yeah. During both, I believe. It was instituted by the Nevi'im, and I think it carried on even at the second Beis HaMikdash, I'm pretty sure. So what's the lesson in my motto? I mean, this is a halacha, this was done, this is a procedure we had to actually institute amongst the entire Jewish people. But I think it's a very important lesson as well. And the lesson is that everyone has to be an active participant in Jewish life. Meaning that there's some things that we say, I can't do that. You know, I'm leaving it to the Kohanim to do. I'm not allowed to go to the Simikdash and offer sacrifices on my own. It has to be the Kohanim. But the prophets understood that we can't just let the Kohanim take charge and have us all just stand back and do nothing. We have to be sure that we're there to show our participation, our support, so we can actually go in and sprinkle blood. We can't burn the animal on the altar. But we can stand there and feel connected. We can daven, we can fast, we can have a special week dedicating ourselves to the service. For us, it's something which is also very important. Let's say, for instance, there's tzedakah that has to be done. And they say, I don't have so much money, I can't give so much tzedakah. But I can show support in other ways. I can't say, well, I'll leave it to the big donors, because I know they have money, I know they're taking care of it, and since I don't have that money, I'm just going to sit back here and do nothing. The answer is, well, you don't have to give money if you don't have the money, but maybe they need some moral support. May they need encouragement. Maybe you could pray on behalf of those who need the tzedakah. Maybe you can help to bring things back and forth. Maybe you can offer a service in other ways. But to say, well, I can't do it, so I'm going to remain passive and not get involved, that's not a Jewish approach. Let's say Torah learning. You know, not everyone's able to study Torah on the highest levels. And, you know, thank God there are many great people out there in yeshivas that study Torah on high levels. To say, that's not for me, I can't do it, I don't have the backgrounds, I don't have the time, I don't have the energy. But to show your support, again, whether it be through time, money, any volunteer work, or just davening on behalf of those who are doing those types of mitzvos, that's part showing that you're participating in it. There could be a chesed that has to be done in the community. All of us are very supportive, let's say, of the Bikur Cholim, or the Arab Association, or the Chevra Kadisha. Every community has their chesed organizations. And maybe some of us can say, I don't have the time, or I don't have the money, I don't have the energy, I don't have the ability to join in and volunteer. So that attitude might be, okay, well, it's being taken care of anyways. Now, I can't be on the Chevra Kadisha. I know they have plenty of good volunteers, so I'm just not going to worry about it. But the answer might be, no, maybe you can't volunteer, but maybe there's something you could do. Maybe you could offer money. Maybe you could offer time. Maybe you can offer prayer. Maybe there's a lot of things you could offer to show. I'm not a passive bystander. I'm an active participant in communal affairs. So I think that's the big lesson of the Maimados. Maimados were an institution made by the prophets to show us you can't just be a passive bystander in the sacrificial service. You can't be there and you can't do it. So just go to your local shul and fast. Go to your local shul and pray. Go to your local shul and learn Torah, thinking about all the offerings, and that's going to show that the entire people participates in it. But don't just leave it up to the Kohanim. And that's that big lesson there. Show your support, be present, be active participants in Jewish life, even in areas that you can't do the actual job, be there on the sidelines showing support. I think that's a big lesson here. There's another point about the Mishmaros, the different shifts of the Kohanim, which is important as well. So we said the Torah understands that order, people are going to fight. Either things won't get done, or it'll cause infighting. And sometimes, though, the fighting can be caused for different reasons. So one reason for fighting would be that, well, you know, I don't want to do the work, and I counted upon you. And you're not doing it either, and we're both being lazy, so then we start bickering at each other, who's going to do it? Well, that's one type of fighting which could occur. And that's a very negative type of fighting, because both of us are being lazy and passive. And that happens. You know, you volunteer for an organization, and nobody really wants to do the job at hand, but we know we're all supposed to. So I rely upon this guy, he relies upon me, and we both rely upon this person over here, and no one does it. And then we start fighting with each other. You're supposed to do this, I'm supposed to do that, you know, and then it creates a big problem. But there's a different perspective as well. And this perspective is also pointed out in terms of this mitzvah. The Kohanim sometimes, if they weren't given an orderly fashion to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, so they would all have this deep burning desire that they want to do the service, and they would come to fighting because they want it to happen. There's a famous story quoted in the Mishnah, the Maseches Yuma. It says that there was a time where, so you had your Mishmar, you had your shift, but yet the specific jobs weren't necessarily divvied out. So they would have like first come, first serve. And there was a time where, so what they would do, if someone wanted to go and, let's say, that the example given is Trumas Hadeshen. Now there was a mitzvah every single morning in the Beis HaMikdash to go and shovel away the ashes off of the altar. And it was an exciting job to do. So the Kohanim would race to get there. Whoever got there first would win. So the Mishnah says that one time Kohanim are racing and they're running up the ramp to the altar, and one guy knocked the other guy off the ramp and he broke his leg. So at that point, the sages said, well, we can't have this, it's too dangerous, and they instituted a lottery. So every morning they make a lottery, and if your number was picked, you get to go and do that service. And all the services were given out through lotteries. But is that looked at as a negative or positive thing? You know, those Kohanim had such a deep burning desire to serve Hashem and do the service in the temple, that even though it created chaos, it was a chaos which we look at, and there certainly is a negative aspect to it, but we can at least appreciate that they were trying their best and putting forth all their energy and might to serve God. They weren't sitting back lazy and saying, okay, you do it, no, you do it, and fighting because no one was doing it. Rather, the fighting occurred because they all really wanted to do it. They were so excited about it. There's a concept the sages describe called Ava Mekakel Sashur. Sometimes love can make you do irrational things. It's such a love for God, and love for God's service. They did things that may have been irrational. So we could say that instituting shifts was to the credit of the Kohanim. It wasn't because they're going to sit back and fight and bicker based on their laziness and their dispassion. Rather, it was because of the passion they had. They had this burning desire to serve God and do what was right no matter what. So even within the Mishmar, in the Beis Av, inside that you had your Mishmar, you had your shift, you had your family working on a certain day, even then they had to institute these lotteries because or else they would all be running to do what they wanted to do, and that would create chaos. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos, it says that when one shift would, when they would have transition between shifts, changing of the guards, so the outgoing shift would give a blessing to the incoming shift. And they would say, Mishashichin Shmo Abayas Hazeh, the one who rested his name upon this house, he should rest amongst you, Ava, love, Yachvam, brotherhood, Vishalom, and peace, Reos, and friendship. Because you should do the avoda peacefully. It shouldn't become chaotic, it shouldn't be barbaric, it should be a very peaceful avoda. But we have to realize that Kohanim at the time, it was because they had such this burning desire to serve God, that's why the peace was disrupted. It wasn't because they were lazy and dispassionate, it was because they really wanted to serve God, and to the best of their abilities, their yearning. I'd like to bring an analogy. Lahabdil, we don't want to compare these two very opposite things. Well, have you ever seen, hopefully you haven't actually experienced it, but people standing at the door of Walmart on Black Friday morning, right? And unfortunately, there have been deaths. People running, I got to get to that electronic. It's an awful, awful thing. But it's because they're so excited about what they can accomplish, they lose focus and they do things which are irrational. So that's a very negative thing because the goal there is material goods. But when the goal is the service of God, so again, you have to respect the yearning desire to serve God. You have to question the chaos which occurred. But yet, understand that the yearning desire to serve God can sometimes bring to this type of chaos, that's not a negative thing. If you ever had the chance to attend, especially you have this in Israel, like a Hasidish Atish on a Friday night. So you can have thousands of Hasidim gathering around to witness the Rebbe in the middle. And it's not a big room. And people are pushing their way in to get there. And for us Americans, you know, we don't like the idea of pushing and chaos. Things are very orderly in America. In Israel, it's not always like that. For those who've experienced, you know, things are not quite as orderly sometimes. And it's not a positive thing necessarily. But when everyone's trying in, they want to be able to just experience being with the Rebbe. For the Hasidim, this is considered an honor for the Rebbe. Because everyone's pushing, they want to have that experience. It's a spiritual experience. And yes, you know, we can say they should make it more orderly, and there's definitely something to that. On the other hand, to show that everyone has this burning desire, they want to get close to the Rebbe and feel that holiness, that's also something to us appreciate. My friends were telling me when I was in Israel last week, so I had some friends who attempted to make it to the funeral of Rav Steinman, that's all. Rav Steinman, he put in his will that he wanted his funeral to be as soon as possible, so he didn't want people to come. He didn't want to have the big honor.
No espedim.
6 hours later, no espedim, but the funeral was made 6 hours after his death, and 500,000 people still came, you know? But you can imagine the chaos to get there, because as soon as everyone heard he died, everyone dropped everything to rush to Bnei Brak to get to his funeral. And my friends were telling me, you know, the buses were packed. You couldn't get there. You get on a bus, you're like a sardine can. You had no way to move. And many people didn't even get on buses because there was so much chaos. One of my friends told me his bus actually got a flat tire along the way, which was, you know. But on the one hand, you say, that's crazy. It's so chaotic. On the other hand, it was all to show honor to this great sage who passed away. And he didn't even want the honor. You know, he said he could have said, okay, have my funeral tomorrow or whatever, tonight, and people have time to get there. He said, as fast as possible. You know, don't delay at all. Not because only the halacha, because he didn't want to have that honor. 500,000 people still came, which is amazing.
I went to Kibbutz Rachel when I was there. It was unbelievable the way people push. It was terrible. It was just awful.
Right.
And the thing is, the carrot just, she's not there. And, you know, it's underground.
Right. Push. Yeah. I'm not praising the pushing. I'm
just getting trampled.
Right. Yeah, that's not a positive thing.
Many buses.
I remember one time with my wife, this is when we were first married. She's pregnant with our first child, and we were going to Hebron, to Marzach Pela, and people were pushing a little pregnant woman. She's getting pushed and shoved. Right. She screamed at them. Yeah. She let them have it. Like, you know?
There were people like that.
Yeah, that's terrible. You know, people have to use a little bit of seichel, a little bit. But I was saying, to understand the desire that sometimes chaos can occur when you're trying to do the right things, so we have to at least appreciate it. So the Torah says, no, make it orderly. I'm just showing where it comes from on the inside. That, you know, it's not just because people don't care; it's because people sometimes care too much. That can also bring to disorder, to an unorderly, chaotic type of situation. So the Torah says make shifts. The rabbis said make a lottery, because we have to be sure that it is orderly. But the place that we're trying to, the issue we're trying to address was that the Kohanim had such a deep desire to serve God, things became disorderly because of that. Now, sometimes we wish this was our issue. You know, our issue in organizations typically is not that. Our issue usually is no one wants to do anything. Everyone's being passive. You know, if the issue in the Chevra Kaddisha or the Erev or the Bikur Cholom was we have so many volunteers, they're all pushing to do all the jobs, that's the disorder. We wouldn't mind that problem. That wouldn't be a bad problem. Our problem typically is the problem that things are chaotic because everyone's being kind of dispassionate and backing away. That's usually our problem. So this mitzvah of the Kohanim making shifts, you know, it seems again to be a kind of esoteric, irrelevant mitzvah. But there's a big lesson for us in life, which is that if you want to be able to run something efficiently, it does require people to be given jobs and shifts and tasks, or else there's going to be fighting, there's going to be inefficiency. Whether it be for good or bad reasons, things will still be inefficient. So that's this mitzvah. Also coming out of Israel, I have one more thought to share. An unrelated thought, but just, I thought I'd take the opportunity. It was something that bothered me this week as I was in Israel, which I wanted to share. For those of you who remember, you go back 20, 30 years ago, and you flew into Israel, especially in El Al, and you would land. So there was like this palpable excitement. Remember this? You used to like play music. People would clap sometimes. Remember that? Yeah. Remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And you're landing in the Holy Land. And I was kind of shocked. I mean, I was there 4 years ago also, but I was on Air Canada, so I didn't expect it. But I was on El Al this time, and I was landing, and there was just no excitement. Like, there was no more music, and no more clapping, and no one seemed to care anymore. Everyone remembers this, right? Everyone remembers this. It used to be such a meaningful thing, because, like, you're entering into the Holy Land. So I was landing, and I was very excited. I haven't been there in a while, and for me, it was a very special, even though I was very busy all week, at least I was in Israel, and that was very special. But the people on the flight, just looking around, there was no more excitement to go anymore.
Maybe because you can't kiss the ground when you come right
away. That's true. You know, I remember those days also. You know, it's a fancy airport now, you're not going onto the ground. But you look around that moment, and everybody's absorbed in their own movie, or they're looking at their phone on airplane mode. It's on airplane mode, of course, but everyone's absorbed in themselves, and nobody seems to take in the moment. And it was, you know, I wasn't surprised by it in the world that we're in, but it was a little bit disturbing to me because, you know, it's something that should be emotional. You know, you think back to your grandparents, great grandparents, going to Israel was a dream. It was the stuff of dreams. You know, people they would risk their lives to travel over mountains and rivers and lakes just to enter into the Holy Land if they were lucky enough to make it there. And we, you know, Baruch Hashem, we have the opportunity to jump on a plane and go and come, no problem. And we can't lose the appreciation of what we're going into. And I think people are so absorbed in their own lives, and especially in the movies they're watching, that they didn't even realize what was happening outside their window until they were told to get off the plane. It reminded me, maybe you've heard this story. In 2007, the Washington Post, they did a social experiment. And they took a world-famous violinist. Did you hear the story? Joshua Bell. And they put him into the DuPont Circle Metro, I think it was, with a $3 million violin to play. He was playing later that night or next day in the Kennedy Center and selling tickets for $100 a person plus. And they stuck him in the metro during rush hour in the morning to see would people actually react to his beautiful music. And the article, I looked it up again, the article says that about 1,070 people passed by, and maybe about 30 even noticed him there. This is this person who was a world-renowned violinist playing a $3 million violin as he was playing at this incredible concert in the Kennedy Center. And no one noticed.
It's a good thing nobody noticed that it was a $3 million.
That could be true.
Yeah.
So a few threw in a few quarters just to, like, you know, support the guy. And I think maybe 20 people actually stopped listening to him, you know, out of over 1,000. And I think that the point of the social experiment was to see what people notice. Beauty based on the surroundings. But I think it's more than that. I think that when people are involved in their busy lives, they neglect just to see the world around them. You know, it's a busy morning, your friend's off to work, everyone has a schedule, they're running through the metro, and you can have the most beautiful music in the world in front of your nose, but you don't even notice it because you're so focused on your own life. And it's a lesson, I took a lesson, you know, from this flight. I was thinking about it all week, that, you know, just to be able to look beyond, you know, our busy lives and notice the world around us sometimes. In last week's parsha, Moshe, we were introduced to Moshe. And Moshe's out, he's grazing his sheep in the wilderness, and he sees the burning bush. So it says that Moshe Rabbeinu, he turned off the path to go take a look at the burning bush. And then the Torah says, V'yar Hashem kisar liros. Hashem saw that Moshe had turned off to look at the burning bush. And commentaries describe that Hashem took note of the fact that Moshe actually turned to look. Many of us would say, oh, interesting, and walk right by. Oh, it's on fire. Cool. You know? Moshe Rabbeinu, he looked at the world around him and said, this is something which is an anomaly. This is strange. It's something I have to go and look at deeper. And he veered off of his busy life to go and see what was happening. And Hashem noted that. Had Moshe just gone on, it could be that Hashem would have chosen someone else. But it says Hashem took note of the fact that Moshe veered off his path. And look, he was a sar. V'yar Hashem kisar. He turned off. Hashem noticed that. And then he called out to him, Moshe, Moshe. But before that point, he didn't call out to him. And to me, that was this exact lesson, that sometimes you have to be able to just veer off the path for a minute and see the world around. It's also with Avraham Avinu. Avraham, who, you know, the first monotheist, first one to discover Hashem. So the Medrash gives an analogy. It says, imagine somebody who's walking and he sees a house with a light on inside. So if there's a light on in the house, you say, there must be a master of the house. There must be a master of the house. So that was Avraham. He saw that this world had a light on, as it were. Then the world functions, the world's beautiful, the world's complex. Avraham thought about it, and Avraham said to himself, there must be a master of the world. The Rambam says that everyone else at the time went about their daily routines. You know, they're idolatrous, they're pagans, and no one really stopped to think. Avraham stopped to think, and therefore he became Avraham. So it's just, we can't let our modern lifestyle, our busy lives, our electronics, anything that keeps us distracted, not allow us to see what's around. We should be inspired by what's around us. Notice the beauty of nature. Notice the settings that we're in. Notice the places that we're in. Or else we're totally lost. When I went into the old city to the Kotel, it was pretty good. People were still pretty focused there. But even that, you have to realize that, you know, when you're in a holy place, recognize where you are, recognize where you're going. But it was sad for me to see that landing on El Al in the Holy Land was no longer the experience that
if
I remember
you
from
clap
years.
Clap hands, everybody will join you.
It could be. You have to be the first to start the clapping hands, right? But they used to even play music. They don't play music anymore. They used to play Israeli music as you're landing. It used to be a whole scene just to land there. You remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was always part of the experience. I was excited to go in El Al and experience that again, and it didn't happen this time. The last time I went, it was Air Canada. I figured Air Canada, maybe they don't do an Air Canada, you know. But El Al, you expect it. So that's my thought from Eretz Yisrael. But I think it's important in a daily life, just not to miss the world around us. You know, it's something that I thought about all week long, and it's, you know, it disturbed me a little bit. So I wanted to share that as well.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
And that was Dr. Kosha.
Thank you.